I first presented this at the ISA DBT conference in November, and I was thinking that this could complement what I talked about there. I really spent most of my time during that talk talking about the research studies for the treatment itself, and then the research to support the physiology of emotion dysregulation problems. So today I want to focus just on reviewing that briefly, but really covering mostly the intervention itself, how to assess for characteristics that will help you determine exactly how to implement resonance frequency slow breathing, also known as pace breathing, one of the components in Marsh's newest emotion regulation skill, the TIP section. Several strategies that she clusters together, breathing being one of the main ones that we're hoping catches on in that cluster of skills.
Milton, can we just have Jim introduce you so we put you in the context of your life and your studies?
Absolutely.
Jim?
Welcome, everybody, to our second research session of 2013, and we're really honored to have Milton Brown with us today. He's a mid-career investigator, clinical worker who really gives one hope for the future in borderline personality disorder developments. He's very bright. He's a graduate of Stanford, went on to get his doctorate at the University of Washington and do a postdoc at Marsha Linehan's clinic. He's now, as you know from the slides, an associate professor. The one thing about he's done more than DBT. This is a man of wide-ranging expertise and experience. But one of the things he did in the DBT field is he was the research assistant for coding tapes, videotapes of therapists for their adherence to the DPT model for borderline. And you may wonder, maybe we'll have time for him to say something about that. His research potential has been recognized with NIMH and Ford Foundation Research Training Awards. And as I mentioned, his experience is wide-ranging. It includes alcohol abuse, dealing with psychological effects from acute physical injury, assessing for brain injury, pain management, and recently he's been working on adapting DBT for the intellectually disabled, and has with his a number of doctoral students a very vigorous and productive research program on shame, which we hope to have him back to tell us about that. So if you have questions, don't hesitate to send them in to neabpd@aol.com. I think we'll have a lot of questions tonight, so don't hesitate, don't be bashful, shoot them in right away. Best chance to get them answered. And tell you, next Sunday we will not be having a session the first Sunday in February. We will defer to the Super Bowl mania. And on February 10th we'll have Connecting the Dots. We have another two holidays in February. On the 17th, President's Day weekend, we will defer to that. And on the last Sunday, the 24th in February, we will have Mike McCluskey. He is a, more than a junior investigator, mid-career investigator you probably are not acquainted with, but he now has two major R01 grants from NIMH that relate to borderline and concerning aggression on the one hand, and the other is possibly question of whether there are suicidal impulses that come from taking SSRIs in their early phase. And in March, just to give you a little preview, we will have Marianne Goodman on the neurobiology and Kim Kratz on group treatment for borderline self-injury. We'll have a really exciting presentation on some data about recovery, and then connecting the dots and concluding in March with a holiday. Lots more after that, so plan to save your Sundays. And with that, let me stop and turn it over to Dr. Brown.
Thank you for that introduction, Jim. So our focus is really emotion regulation, of course, in of course, especially in treating borderline personality disorder. But so many disorders, the core is emotion dysregulation. And so in utilizing DBT and other cognitive behavioral approaches, we want to do the best job possible at giving clients strategies for when they get triggered, when they get upset, when they get dysregulated, how to reduce an emotion episode, how to contain it, and enable them to get back on track with effective behaviors. And we all have heard throughout all of our trainings, going back years and years, one primary piece of advice has always been, take a deep breath, take a deep breath. We've all heard that. And I've seen this strategy come out of DBT and applied in DBT therapy sessions, the ones that I've investigated, that I've coded for adherence when I was involved in Marcia's research projects. Saw a lot of that recommendation. And other projects I've been involved with where I've seen therapists role play their strategies that they would do with clients who are calling for skills coaching. Same advice, take a deep breath, take a deep breath. And what I've seen in those situations is just a small fraction of what I've seen in the last few years since I've been fortunate enough to be a colleague with one of the world's experts on biofeedback. An expert on what's officially called resonance frequency slow breathing. So what I often see in practice is therapists recommending clients breathe slowly, and it's usually the effect of that, what I've seen, is that clients take a few breaths and then they believe that's enough to help them. And very often it's not actually any slower than normal pace. It's something like this. You know, they take in a lot of air and they huff it out. And what I've seen from my colleague, who his name is Richard Gewurz, he's a colleague of mine at the San Diego campus at Alliant where I teach. What they get clients to do is to breathe really slowly, considerably more slow than normal, and to build up a practice of 20 minutes per day, and to really get solidly established at breathing considerably more slowly than normal. And what clients do who go through this form of breathing retraining that's facilitated by biofeedback, they end up having the ability to breathe much more slowly than normal. And it's just so radically different from what most psychotherapists get their clients to do when trying to get them to emotionally regulate through deep or slow breathing. And so I've come to realize that we are probably so underutilizing this strategy of slow breathing. So it comes out of the biofeedback research, and it ties to the physiological mechanisms of heart rate variability, of heart rate variability as being a marker of emotion dysregulation. Oh, right, I need to point out to you, if you are connected to the Internet right now, I actually posted all my slides and a few other tools and handouts on my website. So I have a lot of breathing tools and resources on my clinic's website. It's dbtsandiego.com. And if when that first page comes up, you'll notice the links on the left. If you click on the link Current Clients, you'll come to a page. And on the lower right portion of the page, there's a section called Breathing Pacers. Right above that header, Breathing Pacers, is a link called Slow Breathing Slides. That's this set of PowerPoint slides that you can access as I go through them. And below that header, there are a few other resources I'll refer to as well. So just in case you don't have any ability to access those right now, I'll try to just describe them so that you'll be able to keep track of what I'm covering. All right, so we're targeting emotion dysregulation, and really what it ties to is how our bodies respond to when a threat is perceived. Everybody knows about the fight-or-flight response, that the sympathetic nervous system gets activated when some type of actual or perceived threat occurs. But what not everybody realizes is that there's a lot of evidence that's coming out from almost all forms of psychopathology, and there are a few studies on borderline personality disorder, that an equal or perhaps even greater physiological issue is that under threat or perceptions of threat, there's an inhibition of the parasympathetic nervous system. It's what's called a vagal withdrawal, and that's associated with a decrease in the moment a decrease of heart rate variability. And so that it now allows a person to very quickly mobilize physiological resources to deal with threats. And so that the result of putting the vagal brake on is that heart rate increases and other physical processes that allow for action readiness. And then when the threat is passed, the parasympathetic nervous system is supposed to reactivate, and so the vagal brake is removed, so to speak, and then the physiology can return to normal levels. And there's a lot of research that low heart rate variability is a characteristic that describes people who are at risk for emotion dysregulation. So generally, low levels of heart rate variability indicates a propensity to have this problem occur when a threat is encountered, that the vagal brake gets applied much more strongly, and it takes a lot longer for that vagal brake to be removed for a person to return to a normal state. And so what heart rate variability is, it's a marker of this activation of the parasympathetic nervous system and indicates autonomic dysregulation. So if you're able to see slide number five, slide number four in the slide set, what you would see is that if you looked at beat-to-beat heart rate across time, if you were to display it on a screen, you would see that heart rate fluctuations under states of emotion dysregulation, they're very erratic. And so, like in a state of frustration, heart rate could increase very quickly from 60 beats per minute to 70 to 68, to 95, to 93, a lot of very quick and sudden fluctuations in heart rate. And then in contrast to that, in an emotional state such as appreciation or calmness, there tends to be much larger and smoother fluctuations between faster and slower heart rate. And that amount of fluctuation is called heart rate variability. And to the extent that the fluctuations are larger and smoother between faster and slower, from breath to breath, it indicates emotion regulation. So this is the process we're targeting with both biofeedback, which is a particular intervention strategy, and resonant frequency slow breathing, which is an attempt to get somebody breathing in their optimal pace in order to regulate in this manner, to maximize heart rate variability. So currently there are three studies that I've located on the parasympathetic nervous system functioning of people with BPD. And this area of research is really in its infancy, but it does indicate that people with borderline personality disorder do have problems with heart rate variability. They have excessively low heart rate variability, and in one of the studies it was compared to another clinical group, social anxiety disorder, and it was found that heart rate variability was even lower in BPD than in this other clinical group. So this is a marker of emotion dysregulation problems in general, but it seems to be more pronounced in borderline personality disorder. Some of the research on the characteristics that are associated with having low heart rate variability in general are higher levels of stress reactivity. People who have relatively low levels of heart rate variability, they have stronger cortisol reactivity responses, stronger startle potentiation responses in response to laboratory stressors. And people who have lower heart rate variability in general, they also have problems. More likely, they have problems with executive function performance. They have problems with sustained attention, work and memory, problems inhibiting responses, problems with flexibility, so like studies that have examined responses to Stroop tests, the go, no-go test, for example. And so what it indicates is that people who have low heart rate variability, they have emotion dysregulation, and it really interferes with the ability to engage the prefrontal cortex and those abilities that tie to emotion regulation. So the strategies in DBT that are tied to these characteristics to enhance emotion regulation I think they generally cluster into several categories. Some of the strategies in DBT, they're designed to reduce vulnerability to emotion triggers. Some are designed to reduce the intensity of emotion episodes. Some are designed to enhance emotion regulation by increasing emotion tolerance. And some strategies enhance emotion regulation by helping people act effectively despite emotional arousal. And these general goals of emotion regulation that fit with the DBT approach, they fit with how relaxation training has always been conceptualized, even with progressive muscle relaxation. It was thought that one of the main functions of progressive muscle relaxation is when people engage in this form of relaxation enough, what it does is, there's some evidence to suggest this is true, that it reduces vulnerability to emotion triggers, and if people practice on a regular basis, they're not as easily bothered by normal emotional triggers or stressors. But it also is that relaxation training gives people a skill for regulating their emotions after they get triggered, so they can return themselves to their emotional baseline. And so this is true with resonance frequency, slow breathing as well. And the mechanism is thought to be that the breathing training itself enhances heart rate variability. So goal number one of relaxation training through the slow breathing intervention is to increase general levels of heart rate variability. And the second goal is to increase people's ability to reverse the problem of vagal withdrawal. So after they encounter stressors, to be able to re-engage the parasympathetic nervous system and to remove that vagal break, in essence. So I'm just going to briefly touch on some of the research studies. There have been several studies, and the research is very young, so there really aren't any definitive conclusions about the efficacy of attempts to manipulate heart rate variability. But there are several studies to look at. One of them was a study of exercise. And exercise is thought to promote emotion regulation actually through one of the same mechanisms as resonance frequency breathing training and heart rate variability biofeedback. It's thought that the mechanism for both vigorous cardiovascular exercise and this breathing retraining is strengthening of baroreflexes. And baroreflexes are reflexes in the circulatory system that help synchronize blood pressure and heart rate as they're related to breathing. And then there's some evidence to suggest that exercise and slow breathing, resonance frequency slow breathing training, they strengthen these reflexes in the circulatory system. And so they're thought to have a common mechanism. So there is a study that has demonstrated that sustained, regular cardiovascular exercise. This particular study was done in a military population, and it was found that the group who maintained exercise compared to a group that was made to stop exercising, that there were higher levels of general levels of heart rate variability and executive functioning, enhancements in performance and executive functioning. So it was a direct manipulation of HRV showing executive function enhancements, which is one key ability that is related to emotion regulation. There are some within subjects experiments, there are like two or three, that have manipulated breathing in the context of a single session. And they have found that when people engage in breathing close to 6 breaths per minute, that they report more experience of calmness and enhancements in heart rate variability in even a single session when people substantially slow down their breathing. So there are two or three studies of that type. And then there are some larger randomized control trials where heart rate variability biofeedback was used as a modality to get people to breathe at their optimal pace, which is called resonance frequency. which I'll explain a bit more later. And so the studies have found favorable results in interventions that have generally, across these studies, been approximately 10 to 20 sessions of once per week meeting with the therapist and getting people to breathe at a frequency that maximizes their heart rate variability. And the biofeedback technique is that people view their physiology on a computer screen and they practice breathing in a manner that maximizes their heart rate variability. And the therapist guides them into the correct breathing technique, abdominal breathing, slow breathing, in a way that maximizes their heart rate variability. And then they're instructed to breathe on a daily basis for at least 20 minutes. And the studies have shown improvements in heart rate variability following a course of breathing, resonance frequency breathing retraining, and reductions in depression scores on the BDI across these studies. That's been the consistent finding. So it's been four studies, so it's not fully established, but it's very promising. These were in populations of major depression and PTSD. So I'm going to cover now implementation of PACE breathing. So resonance frequency breathing is breathing done at an extremely slow pace, about 5 to 6 breaths per minute. And this is in contrast to what most people breathe at normally, about 10 to 12 breaths per minute. So most of us breathe about 10 breaths per minute. So this is about half the normal speed of breathing. It's substantially slower than normal. And if you compare it to people who are chronically emotionally dysregulated and those who hyperventilate, it could be as much as 18 to 20 breaths per minute. So for some of our clients, this is substantially slower than normal. So it's characterized by a slower pace. And another characteristic of resonance frequency breathing is that breathing is synchronized with oscillations in heart rate and blood pressure. And that characteristic is called respiratory sinus arrhythmia. It's a form of heart rate variability when breathing is synchronized with heart rate and blood pressure fluctuations. And the way that that looks, if you were to look at the graph, if you have that graph in front of you, is that on the inhale, at the peak of the inhale, is the fastest heart rate. And on the end of the exhale is the lowest heart rate. So those become synchronized. The breathing synchronized with heart rate fluctuations. And the goal in doing heart rate variability biofeedback or simple resonance frequency breathing is to create the largest possible heart rate decrease on each exhale. And so through all these procedures, you have a client hooked up to a physiological recording equipment, and you watch the fluctuations in heart rate that correspond with breathing. And on the exhale, you watch how much the heart rate decreases on each exhale. And to the extent that that is the largest possible decrease, those are breathing methods that you encourage the client to do again. So you can show them the screen and draw their attention to breaths that have decreased their heart rate on the exhale. And giving them that feedback enables them to know what they did in order to put the brake on, so to speak, to decrease their heart rate on the exhale. And so the goal is to maximize heart rate fluctuations from faster to slower, synchronized with the breathing. And so clients slow down their breathing close to 5 to 6 breaths per minute, and what will be observed is smooth, tall heart rate waves. Heart rate increasing on the inhale, decreasing on the exhale. And a characteristic of when the breathing becomes synchronized to heart rate in that manner and the fluctuations become large between faster and slower heart rate what also happens is that the heart rate fluctuations become very smooth. So what you'll see on the screen in front of you when a person's heart rate is displayed is large, smooth heart rate waves, large, smooth heart rate fluctuations, smoothly increasing to faster, faster, faster. At the peak of the inhale, starting to slow down, heart rate slowing down. At the end of the exhale, slowing down considerably in a smooth transitioning from faster to slower. And so that quality of smooth heart rate fluctuations from breath to breath is called coherence. So that's another thing we look for on the screen to verify that a person is breathing optimally. And so this visual feedback from seeing a person's heart rate fluctuations tells us if they are getting to their optimal breathing. Whatever they do to maximize those smooth, large heart rate fluctuations is what we tell them is their target breathing pattern. And the largest influence on this optimal heart rate fluctuation pattern is breathing pace. A lot of characteristics of breathing can influence it, but there's evidence that the biggest influence is breathing pace. So whenever somebody gets to their best pace, something approximately 5 to 6 breaths per minute, the heart rate fluctuations become large and smooth from faster to slower. And if you have the slides in front of you, slide 16 shows that when somebody is breathing at 12 breaths per minute, their heart rate fluctuations will be, they'll look something like what you see on that slide right there. The graph in front of you there, if you have that, it shows somebody breathing at 12 breaths per minute and the heart rate fluctuating between 90 and 91 beats per minute. That's a very small amount of variability in heart rate, from 90 to 91 and then 93 to 90. So that's not very healthy physiologically, and it's not very healthy in terms of emotion regulation. If you look on the next slide, it shows what you might see if somebody were breathing at 7 breaths per minute. Those are much larger fluctuations in heart rate. And what that slide shows is that the heart rate for that particular person is fluctuating between about 85 beats per minute at the peak of that first first inhale, and on the exhale, the heart rate drops to about 75 beats per minute. And then up on the next inhale to 85, on the next exhale down to 75, and so that's about a 10 beats per minute difference for that individual breathing at 7 breaths per minute. So that is an enhancement in heart rate variability that we knew is true for that individual because we would slow down their breathing and look for the impact on the smoothness and the largeness of those heart rate fluctuations, those heart rate waves that would be displayed on the computer monitor. Now, if you look on the next slide, slowing that same person down to 5 breaths per minute results in a heart rate variability of 93 beats per minute on that first peak of the peak of that first inhale, and then dropping to 59 beats per minute on the end of that exhale following the one I just mentioned, and then going back up to about 92, 93 on the peak of the next inhale, and going down to about 60 on the end of the next exhale. So at 5 breaths per minute for that person, you can see that the heart rate fluctuations are even larger, even smoother than what we saw at 7 breaths per minute. So that's an enhancement of heart rate variability. So we're directly manipulating heart rate variability through manipulating breathing, and specifically manipulating breathing pace, slowing down considerably the pace of the breathing to what is more optimal for that individual. So now remember, heart rate variability is one of the main markers of an emotion dysregulation state. It's small, erratic fluctuations in heart rate. And now, through slowing the breathing, you can verify by looking at the screen for heart rate fluctuations for that individual, we enhance this marker of larger heart rate variability. So this is good. This is an effective intervention for shifting somebody's state towards emotion regulation. Another characteristic that you can see on the next slide, which you won't usually be able to directly observe because most of us won't have the equipment to do so, but you see on this next slide that as a person approaches resonance, which is their unique optimal breathing rate, And for this person, it's 5 breaths per minute, the one I'm displaying here on this slide. I think it's slide 19. There's a synchrony now, not only between breathing and heart rate fluctuations, as I mentioned, there's a synchrony with both of those with blood pressure fluctuations. So when a person gets close to resonance, their optimal rate, at the peak of an inhale, the very end of an inhale, the graph shows that the heart rate is at its highest point and the blood pressure is at its lowest point. And then as a person exhales, at the very end of their exhale, heart rate drops to its lowest point in a breathing cycle and blood pressure is at its highest point during a breathing cycle. So when heart rate is at its lowest point, blood pressure is at its highest point. So they're opposite to each other in phase, but perfectly synchronized. So the synchrony of the blood pressure and the heart rate and the breathing with through every breath cycle indicates synchrony in the physiological systems. And so that's really what the meaning of resonance is. It means all the body systems, the circulatory and breathing systems, are synchronized, and so it's an efficient and optimal state of autonomic functioning. So this is why it's called resonance frequency breathing. It's optimal in all of those senses. And so breathing pace is the number one characteristic that is related to achieving resonance, physiological resonance. But there's some other characteristics that pretty much all experts agree are important. Number one, breathing primarily from the lower abdomen, utilizing the diaphragm muscle, and not utilizing, for the most part, upper chest muscles. So if you watch somebody do diaphragmatic breathing, you can watch to see whether their shoulders and chest are moving versus their abdomen. So this is something that people can observe directly, and if they have trouble, they can place a hand on the abdomen and on the chest and watch the movement of the two areas of the body. The movement should be coming from down low, not up high. So lower abdomen breathing is thought to be more effective. Upper chest breathing is thought to promote hyperventilation, which is the opposite of our goal during this. There's some research to suggest that a longer exhale is more effective for getting somebody to their resonance state, more effective for activating the parasympathetic nervous system. And so if somebody, for example, were to breathe at 6 breaths per minute, that's equivalent to a 10-second breath cycle from the start of a peak of an inhale all the way to the end of the exhale and back to the peak of the next inhale. That would be 10 seconds. 10 seconds for a whole breath cycle would equal 6 breaths per minute. For a lot of people, that's about what they need. And so if we were utilizing this principle of a longer exhale, it would mean a person breathing in for about 4 seconds and breathing out for about 6 seconds. And so part of the instruction to clients can be to count the inhale approximately 4 seconds, depending on what their optimal breathing pace is, what their particular resonance frequency is. But somewhere around 3 seconds inhale and somewhere around 6 seconds exhale is thought to be optimal. And the point is that research really, really strongly suggests that the exhale is the part of the breathing that activates the parasympathetic nervous system. So on every exhale, you can see a slowing down of the heart rate, and that is the activation of one of the vagus nerves that slows the heart rate down. On the exhale is when the heart gets slowed down. That's when the vagal break is removed. That's when the parasympathetic response becomes stronger. It's on the exhale. So the idea is to extend the exhale in order to have an extra chance to apply that parasympathetic response, to kick that in a little bit more than might occur otherwise if the exhale wasn't quite as long. Okay? So longer exhale. Another strategy is to get clients to purse their lips on the exhale. And the reason for pursing lips means is that the lips become tighter, as if a person's puckering for a kiss, as if they are sucking through a straw. So a much smaller opening through the lips. And the idea is that a lot of people have trouble slowing their exhale down enough. And so by making a smaller opening, it's more likely that the air will release a lot slower, thus slowing down the exhale. And so something that you can look for to make sure clients are exhaling slowly enough is that they make a sound. So you can suggest that clients actually make a sound on the exhale, a hissing sound. And that means they're closing the opening and releasing air at a slower pace. So it's a good idea to have them make that sound on the exhale, partly so you can keep track of their breathing. Many of you are not going to have a breathing strap in order to measure breathing in an optimal way. So you actually need to be able to hear it so you can know if they're breathing at the correct pace. But also it's going to help them slow their breath down, their exhale down, in order for them to be able to breathe at the slower pace. So that's called pursed lips breathing, highly recommended. So I have some slides here on a feasibility study that I've done with one of my students, 15 participants with borderline personality disorder. I'll just summarize it really briefly. You can check out some of the details on the slides if you haven't already gotten those. It was 8 to 10 sessions of heart rate variability biofeedback to help people breathe at their resonance frequency. We asked participants to practice for 20 minutes per day, and we measured outcomes on a bunch of self-report measures and of anxiety and depression and motion regulation skills. And we measured how acceptable the intervention was to them. So most people, actually 80%, they achieved mastery of the breathing by the second session. So they were able to breathe approximately 5 to 6 breaths per minute. And they were comfortable with that. And most of them enjoyed it as well. And they most of them also did the homework practice, so they caught on with it, and they were very willing to practice. Approximately 62% practiced consistently. Only one person, 8%, did not like to breathe in and didn't practice it very much. Most of them reported it as being helpful. There are a few graphs thrown in there as well, so you can see changes on the DERS and borderline symptom checklist, so that those data are there for you to look at. Okay, slide 25, if you're following along. It shows the different phases of the intervention. So phase one is designed to assess a person's baseline respiratory sinus arrhythmia, HRV, so how big are their heart rate fluctuations under normal conditions before you intervene, from breath to breath. To assess their baseline HRV and to establish their resonance frequency. So that is to check the actual data for that particular individual on what is their actual optimal breathing pace. That's phase one. Phase two of the intervention is to get the person to practice breathing at resonance frequency at that particular pace, what's best for them, whatever it takes. And so early on, there is often use of a pacing stimulus or visual feedback from the physiological recording equipment. They can count to themselves, whatever helps them breathe at the pace, just so they can practice breathing at that pace, get used to it, and start to master it. Phase three is when we get a person to transition off of crutches, aids, and stimuli and to be able to do it more autonomously. So phase three is where we target getting them to do it and testing how effective they are doing it, breathing at resonance frequency autonomously with minimal prompting, basically. Phase four is when we work with them to quickly engage their resonant frequency breathing, even when they're distressed, under conditions of emotional arousal. And so sometimes we practice that during exposure therapy. So they have to be able to kick it in, breathe more slowly, even when they're reacting to something, and physiologically, their physiology is the opposite of slow breathing. So that's the whole point. We want to slow them down to reverse that response that they get in their body when they're triggered. So that's really, really challenging. We slowly work up to that. Phase five is when we confirm that a person can quickly engage their RSA and quickly achieve optimal HRV, recovering from stressors. All right, so phase one is really important. It's the assessment phase and the determination of resonance frequency. So now we're on slide 26. So the standard in the field is to have breathing pacers at your fingertips with a client, and you take them through a handful of paces, and you empirically verify which pace is optimal for a particular client. And so what's considered adequate are two-minute recordings where you sample heart rate oscillations at each of these paces, and you record a sample of physiological data at all these paces, and you quantify it. There's a way to quantify each two-minute segment at the different paces to get one number to tell us how good the person's HRV is. So you want to take them from 7 breaths per minute and recording that for 2 minutes, and then down to 6.5 breaths per minute, recording 2 minutes of that, 2 minutes of 6 breaths per minute, 5.5 breaths per minute, 5 breaths per minute, 4.5, and if necessary, you can go a little bit slower than that. So at each of those paces, at least 2 minutes of recording of the heart rate fluctuations when people are paced at those speeds. And so you'll see on my website I have on that page I told you about, there are a whole bunch of breathing pacers. And so these are MP3 files that you want to have at your fingertips. You can put them on your iPhone. I ask my clients to put them on their iPhones or whatever smartphones they have or whatever devices they have for playing music to put these sound breathing pacers on their devices. What they are is they're guitar strums that go from ascending tones, transitioning to descending tones, and then ascending tones. And on the ascending tones, that's the signal to inhale, and on the descending tones, that's the signal to exhale. So each of those different audio files goes through those tones at different paces, different cycles per minute. So all the way from 4.5 to 9 breaths per minute are those different audio files. So you have those ready on the computer or on your device, whatever that is, and you take a person through the sequence of breathing paces, getting two-minute samples. And I recommend, in order to be able to do this step, that you, unless you have $2,000 to buy the really, really good equipment, you buy equipment that really does the job quite adequately. It has all the basic features, can't really do anything fancy, but it can take you through this phase one step of assessing heart rate variability at each of the paces. On my webpage, you'll see above the header breathing pacers, called other resources, there are several options there for biofeedback devices, which is the technology you'll need. MyCombeat is one of the ones there. I think it sells for $70, $80. And the one I currently have is M-Wave, which is the third one on that list there. And if you have the slides in front of you, it's on slide 27. There's a picture there of the actual computer screen. And you can see on that screen the fluctuations in heart rate that correspond with each breath cycle. And you can see how big the fluctuations are there on that screen. And all you need to do is press record once a person is hooked up. And it's very easy to hook somebody up. There are light sensors that you can attach to the finger, the index finger, or to a person's earlobe. And you simply attach the sensor in that manner. You plug it into your computer. You get the software running. You press record, and you can capture a two-minute sample or longer of heart rate fluctuations. And at the end of the recording, you press stop. And then I circled on that slide the button you need to press. That's called Heart Rate Variability Power Spectrum. So what that does is it'll kick in some really, really fancy math through a complicated process called Fourier analysis, and it'll come up with one number to quantify the amount of heart rate variability. And so on the screen that comes up after you click that button, there is a graph at the bottom that will be a number somewhere between 40 and 2,000. And you look at the y-axis of that screen, and that tells you how tall is the peak that's displayed on that graph. It'll be somewhere around 0.10 hertz, which is a different math for saying 6 cycles per minute. And so that peak, the size of that peak, will tell you how effective that 2-minute breathing sample was for enhancing heart rate variability. So you go through all the paces, and you compare that number. It's in a metric which doesn't really mean anything except more is better. It's in milliseconds squared. And so whatever number, whatever breathing pace generates that highest number in that Fourier analysis and that HRV power spectrum part of the program, that tells you which breathing pace was optimal, whichever enhanced heart rate variability to the greatest extent. So it's an empirical test for that individual about what is best for them, what enhances their HRV to the biggest extent possible. And usually it'll be between about 5.5 to 6 breaths per minute. But a lot of research has shown that what's optimal for an individual can vary as much as, for some people, the best is 4.5 breaths per minute, and for some people it's close to 6.5 or 7 breaths per minute, where for those individuals, breathing at those particular paces really enhances their HRV much more than other paces. And for somebody else, it can be quite different. So it's not a one-size-fits-all breathing retraining strategy. It is individualized by checking for each individual what is best for them. And so it's an empirical check. For that person, what's best for them. And there are some predictors in case you don't have the equipment. People who are taller and men, they generally have a resonance frequency, an optimal pace, that is quite a bit slower than women or shorter people. So a really tall man, on average, optimal pace would be somewhere closer to 5 or maybe even 4.5 breaths per minute. For a really short woman, the optimal pace, resonance frequency, could be much closer to 6.5 breaths per minute. There's quite a bit of variability around those predictions as well, but those are some general predictors of what the person's optimal pace. But you're going to, if at all possible, you just verify for that individual. So here are a few other tools I want to point out to you in our remaining time. One is on slide 28. It's a 2-minute breathing test. So in phase 3 of the training, after you've assessed a person's optimal pace, you have them following a pacer at their optimal pace, their resonance frequency. In sessions, between sessions, you get them very familiar with breathing at that pace. Phase 3 is getting them to breathe autonomously, being able to kick in, breathing at their best pace, even without any special prompting, so that they can make better use of this as a skill that will generalize across situations. They want to make it their own, right? So there are several strategies we have for phase 3. Probably the easiest one for participants to do in the process of making this a skill that they can make use of autonomously is a 2-minute breathing test. So it's on the web page as well. If you click on the link, it's the first one under the breathing pacers header, 2-minute breathing test. You'll see a graphic reproduced several times on the page of an up and down zigzaggy pattern. And so what that is a prompt for somebody to look at the paper. You print it out as a sheet, as a handout. And at the start, you set a timer for 2 minutes, and at the start of the timer, a person traces that up and down line in accordance with their breathing. So on their exhale, they trace with a pen or a pencil down a down mark on that zigzaggedy line, and they keep their pen or pencil on in contact with the paper the whole time. And on the inhale, they trace the up line in that zigzaggy pattern. Up and down, corresponding with breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. And what they can do is track to see how many breaths they're taking in that span of time. And at the end of 2 minutes, you stop the timer, and they can set this themselves as well, or you can do it with them in sessions. They stop the timer, and wherever they end up along that zigzaggy pattern tells them what their breathing pace was. So if they made it to... if they got in 2 minutes down through, I think it's 24 of those cycles, they would end up where that dashed line is, and that would be 6 breaths per minute. That would be enough breathing cycles in 2 minutes in order to equal 6 breaths per minute. Some feedback for them about how well they were doing modulating their pace so that they can breathe at their resonance frequency. So the task is to do this over and over and over again until they're able to breathe at their target pace, and this is a way to put them to the test. A little bit harder test is for individuals to time 10 breath cycles. And so I have on slide number 29 a little table to tell you how long 10 breaths should take for somebody who has a resonance frequency, an optimum pace, at each of those different paces. So you can see from that table on slide 29, somebody whose target pace, their resonance frequency, is 6 breaths per minute, across 10 breaths, that should last 1 minute and 40 seconds. for somebody whose optimal pace, their resonance frequency, is 5 breaths per minute, 10 breaths should last 2 minutes even. Okay? So what you do is you give them a challenge. You give them a chance to demonstrate their ability to regulate their breathing and to regulate their physiology. You tell them they will have 10 breaths. You tell them what their target amount of time is. And if needed, they can count themselves. With every breath, they can count set number of seconds for each inhale and each exhale to try to pace themselves. And you basically put them to the test. At the end of 10 breaths, you stop the timer, and you see how much time it took for them to breathe 10 breaths. And in examining the difference between how much time it actually took them to breathe 10 breaths with what their target amount of time was, they can get a sense with each practice attempt how well they're honing in on being able to reproduce the target breathing pace. So the idea is to go through the practice over and over and over again until they get the prompt, breathe at resonance frequency, and they take 10 breaths and they end right on the mark. A person whose target is 5 breaths per minute, if they end right on the 2-minute mark, it means they're right on target and they're able to kick in the resonance frequency breathing with very minimal prompting. So that's a very important step for them to be able to make it their own strategy that they can utilize across a variety of situations. So it should promote generalization, their ability to be able to kick this in as needed. So there are some predictable problems I just want to go through really quickly. It's on the last slide. Number one is a lot of patients, in my experience with trying to apply this to BPD, approximately 20%, they really struggle breathing slowly, and they just say they can't do it. They say, I just can't breathe that slowly, and they get frustrated sometimes. Sometimes it's the performance demand that frustrates them, or there's something physiological about it that's a really big barrier for them. And in almost all those cases, the solution has been to take a more gradual approach. And so even the assessment of seeing, which hopefully generally occurs in the first session, how well they do breathe in at each of the slow paces, going as slow as 5 breaths per minute. Hopefully that generally occurs in the first sessions. But some clients, they can't get any slower than 6.5 breaths per minute in the first session. So you can't even test which paces are the best for them because they can't get slow enough. In almost all cases, stretching out the practice across 3, 4, 5, or 6 sessions, which most people don't need, but some people do, stretching it out where you gradually have a person breathe as slowly as they can and then gradually getting them to a pacer that's a little bit slower, a little bit slower, a little bit slower, maybe across 3, 4, or 5 sessions, they can eventually get down to 6 breaths per minute or a little bit slower. So you can check out what's most effective for them. For some people, they just need a much more gradual approach, and that's a very effective way to get them past that barrier. And another very common complaint is that a lot of patients say that they get lightheaded or dizzy in doing slow breathing, and so they just stop breathing altogether. They stop the slow breathing practice altogether because it's really uncomfortable for a lot of people. And so usually what that's attributed to is that when people start to breathe more slowly, they compensate for the slower pace by taking in a lot more air. And that's the physiological explanation for that effect that makes them uncomfortable. So the normal instruction is to pay attention to that and try to get people, if that happens, to take in less air than they were when at the times they were feeling lightheaded or dizzy. Taking in less air with each breath often is the solution. Sometimes they need to take in more air, sometimes less air. So it's something that can be tested out to see what is the amount of air at slower paces that reduces the lightheaded or dizzy feelings. A lot of patients continue to breathe from their upper chest, even though we prompt them to breathe diaphragmatically. A really useful strategy for that component is to have people lay down on their backs and put a weight on the abdomen, such as a book or something, and practice breathing in a way that raises that object or the book or whatever it is, and then letting gravity bring the abdomen down on the exhale. And then using the diaphragm muscle to raise up the book or whatever the object is on the inhale. So that's a practice that makes it a little bit easier for people. There are a lot of people, here's the last problem I've encountered, who can do the slow breathing under ideal circumstances when they're calm in a therapy room which is not really ultimately what they need to do, be able to do it when they're already comfortable and calm. They need to be able to kick it in when they're stressed out and triggered. So a lot of patients got the basic practice down, but they really struggle engaging resonance frequency breathing under challenging circumstances with no prompts or under conditions of emotional arousal. The usual problem there is people just don't practice enough, and they don't practice enough in context. So it's really important to convey the idea that the benefit is in proportion to the amount of practice. A lot of clients don't practice enough, and what's really recommended is kind of the standard for people to be able to utilize the skill really well, 20 minutes a day, almost every day, until they get really solid in their abilities. So that's kind of essential for a lot of people. And so that's essential, but doesn't guarantee that somebody will be able to engage their resonance frequency breathing when they're distressed. So in addition, they need to mix up the practice. Practice in therapy, practice outside of therapy, practice under neutral conditions, practice under challenging circumstances in the presence of triggers or stressors. It can be done in the presence of doing a Stroop task, serial sevens, during exposure therapy, all kinds of, or naturally occurring stressors. There are all kinds of opportunities that can be utilized to get people to practice under a wide range of circumstances, neutral and stressful. And so the ability to be able to kick in the skill under all circumstances is the extent to which people practice under a wide variety of circumstances. So those are really the highlights, and I'd like to answer a few questions.
Oh, Mel, thank you. This is just absolutely incredible. I think across the country I can hear this slow breathing taking out. What a terrific session. Among the comments about it, I'll just read one briefly. Wow, this is so good. Explains so much. The reason why makes all the difference. It's just a super, super job. Thank you so much. I would mention if you described some inexpensive ways that certainly would work to slow breathing by timing and related to the computer. There's also something called the respirate, R-E-S-P-E-R-A-T-E. Mm-hmm. And it's a little device that helps you slow breathing in order to lower blood pressure.
Yes, I've seen that.
And it works well enough that the conservative National Health Service will pay for it through a prescription. You need to have your, if you're English, you need to have your blood pressure lowered. So, you know, there's other evidence as well for this. Let me turn to some of the, got a 2 minutes for questions. You told us about how easy this is to learn and some of the difficulties, which was great. One question was, are there audio CDs or DVDs that can help on learning these techniques? Have you found anything helpful beyond your very clear and lucid instructions?
There really aren't any audio training mechanisms other than just on audio, just the breathing pacers themselves. There are a couple manuals that you can find that are published by Paul Lehrer, L-E-H-R-E-R. He's one of the originators of a lot of the research on this strategy. It might be in that reference list that I have on the last slide. I'm not sure. I have to look there. Written manuals. There are some written manuals. There's nothing audio or video on any of this training.
Okay. And then for those who have trouble with breathing or for which DBT doesn't bring them to enough emotional control, are there other techniques or methods that are available that you would recommend?
For slow breathing or emotion regulation, I'm sorry?
Emotional regulation.
Well, there's one that's even less research, which I think is promising, but it probably works through a different mechanisms. I mean, they're all in DBT now because Marcia wants everything possible, including DBT with empirical evidence or promising preliminary evidence even. So she has, for instance, the cold water skill, the dive reflex skill, That really profoundly changes physiology in ways that we presume are tied to emotion dysregulation, but the links are not all clearly, haven't clearly been made in research yet. I do the dive reflex technique with my clients, and Marcia does it a lot as well. We all know it as face dunking. I think most of us here have heard about it quite a few times over the years. Getting patients to dunk their face in cold water, really cold water, and the research suggests it should be around, really as cold as possible, but most people, it becomes painful around below 40 degrees, so we generally want to avoid the pain problem with that. So between 40 and 50 degrees, face dunking for as long as a person could possibly hold their face in a bucket of cold water, that really changes physiology. But that's not really well established yet for emotion dysregulation problems. But I think it's promising. Exercise is effective for changing physiology that's likely tied to emotion, but I can hardly get my clients to exercise at all, especially when they're distressed, let alone really at any time. I've seen it as a very low probability behavior for most clients. Progressive muscle relaxation has a ton of evidence to support it. I also have failed miserably at getting most of my clients to do that, hardly ever have succeeded. Some clients will do it, but most of my clients will not. But it works really well. You have to be really disciplined to do progressive muscle relaxation. Most people don't want what it takes to do it really well.
We have hit our time limit, and I'm sorry to those who had other questions, but this has just been absolutely incredible. I'm going to use this for our other speakers that asked for a model, and I'm going to use your tape as a model.
Wow, thank you so much. Glad to help.
So thank you so much, and have a great evening. And everybody else, have a terrific week. Enjoy the Super Bowl, and tune in for listening 2 weeks from tonight.
Thanks, Milton, and thanks so much, Jim, too.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye, everyone.